Welcome to Oak City Church, a family of learners, lovers, and givers sent. For more information, visit us online at oakcitychurch.com. Let us know if we can help you in any way. Thank you for listening.
Today, I have the privilege of reading Psalm 139. And then, if I remember, I'm going to say at the end, this is the word of God, and you're going to say, thanks be to God. This is such a personal psalm that I invite you, if you'd like, to just close your eyes and listen to it. Oh, yeah. Would y'all would think? Would stand up? Y'all are so well-trained. Good job. So if you'd like, and if it's helpful to concentrate on it, feel free to shut your eyes, or you could read along. This is a psalm to the choir master. It's a psalm of David. O Lord, you have searched me and known me. You know when I sit down and when I rise up. You discern my thoughts from afar. You search out my path and my lying down and are acquainted with all my ways. Even before a word is on my tongue, behold, O Lord, you know it all together. You hem me in behind and before and lay your hand upon me. Such knowledge is too wonderful for me. It is high. I cannot attain it. Where shall I go from your spirit? Or where shall I flee from your presence? If I ascend to heaven, you are there. If I make my bed in Sheol, you are there. If I take the wings of the morning and dwell in the uttermost parts of the sea, even there your hand shall lead me, and your right hand shall hold me. If I say, surely the darkness shall cover me and the light about me be night, even the darkness is not dark to you. The night is bright as the day, for darkness is as light with you. For you formed my inward parts. You knitted me together in my mother's womb. I praise you, for I am fearfully and wonderfully made. Wonderful are your works. My soul knows it very well. My frame was not hidden from you when I was being made in secret, intricately woven in the depths of the earth. Your eyes saw my unformed substance. In your book were written every one of them, the days that were formed for me, when as yet there was none of them. How precious to me are your thoughts, O God. How vast is the sum of them. If I would count them, they are more than the sand. I awake, and I am still with you. This is the word of the Lord.
Thanks, Susan. Good morning. Thanks for being with us this morning. If you're online, we're glad that you tuned in and that you could join us that way. If you've been online for a while but have not been here yet, we would love for you to come visit us. We're in week three of 4 weeks of a series called Where is God When Life Happens? And next week we will finish that and move on. And this week we get to talk to John, but we talk to John all the time. And so we get to talk to Kate Fouché, his daughter. So everybody say, hi, Kate.
Hi.
You guys don't know Kate as well. And you haven't seen Kate around much because a year ago, you were graduating from Appalachian State University. And then you moved to Vermont to in the middle of the winter to live in a cabin with no heat.
Yeah.
And had just a fireplace.
Yeah, it's kind of a bad idea.
And I asked John on a regular basis, like, has she got eaten by a bear yet? Like, is this, I was concerned.
I appreciate that. Thank you.
Yeah. And
not eaten by a bear.
So she made it. You were at a camp. You were at a camp working with kids and went, got through the summer and then decided to move back home.
Yeah.
And so we're glad that you're here. This morning. This is Kate's story, John's going to interject a little bit. Lindsay would be up here, but she wasn't feeling well this morning, so she couldn't make it. John and Lindsay in this story could have their own Where is God When Life Happens morning, but this is not that morning. So John is going to has a few questions to answer, but for the most part, this is going to be Kate's story. So, all right, so we'll just start with a little background prelude to the story. You are, how old are you?
I am 24.
And you have, tell me, how old are your siblings?
My siblings are 28, 14, and 11.
And they're all boys?
They sure are.
So, so you are the only girl with three boys? That's like my daughter. So you were his favorite daughter.
Yeah. Sorry, guys.
And your growing up was pretty. So you have a little bit of a middle child thing. And as we're talking to really, Kate's always kind of doing the right thing.
Yeah.
He has described you in the past as like, this is just the easiest kid you could ever have. Like, she's on it.
Yeah.
To like as prelude to this story, like there are some things that happened probably starting in your middle school years, in your family that, good gracious, me and this microphone are gonna have it out. That created some stress and your situation. So one of those things was, it was you and Sterling, and it's your older brother, mm-hmm. And as we've gone through, a handful of times before, John was preaching about abortion, and God was like, well, what are you doing? And like, changed the course of your family and everybody's life, and got you guys, Wesley and Aiden. Blessed thing.
Yep.
But at the beginning was a disruptive, as adoption just is, a disruptive thing. And so the boys came into your life when you were how old?
10 and 13. Wesley.
Oh, okay.
Well, Wesley was adopted when I was 10 and Sterling was 14. And then Aiden came in when I was 13 and Sterling was 17.
Yeah.
Wesley was.
And you were all in on that.
Oh, yeah. Very almond.
Hold your mic a little bit closer.
Here. Is this a good? Oh, I can hear it now. Okay. Yes. Very much all in. I was homeschooled to kind of help take care of the boys a little bit. And was doing well in school. But a 3-year-old and a 1-year-old took a lot of work. I shared a room with Aiden. We love to tell a story about one morning he woke up as a baby and was in his crib and was crying, going, "Mama, Mama." And so my mom comes in, because he's calling for her, and she walks up to his crib and he goes, "No, the other Mama." and was calling for me. And so we've always been incredibly close, but it was a lot of kind of pressure, and I just grew up very quickly in those years that they were young.
And it created tension in the family. We've talked about this. It created tension between you and your parents, which was just a whole load on you. There was a lot going on with you, with Lindsay, and so... when you have two kids and things are stable and then all this other stuff is happening in your family as a result of it, it takes some attention away from you, but like things are going on with you and it's, people don't know that. In that, your grandmother dies and that was significant for you.
Mm-hmm.
And then you guys, after your 9th grade year, you move from Johnson City, Tennessee to Raleigh.
Mm-hmm.
And so you had gone from being homeschooled through 8th grade,
mm-hmm.
to going to a school in 9th grade and making a new group of friends?
A little bit, yeah.
And then you leave that group of friends after ninth grade, mm-hmm. and then 10th grade is not an easy grade to come in and make friends.
Not a great time.
Yeah. And it wasn't, I mean, you came here, you went to a school called Longleaf, which was, mm-hmm. is that like a charter, mm-hmm. charter school for the arts? Mm-hmm. You made some friends. It's not like your grades were going in the tank or anything like that.
Right.
But all these things, it slowly, like things were happening inside of you that were slow and maybe imperceptible of what was going on. And you made the comment that depression can happen without big life changes, mm-hmm. but these were kind of the big life changes, mm-hmm. that facilitated that with you. And on the outside, you look good, but on the inside, there was kind of this growing sense of despair. So to put this in a timeline, when we talked the other day, you said like, you felt like it's kind of started in 2012, and that's when your grandmother died, and mm-hmm. then in 2015 is when you moved, and then 2017 is where you hit bottom. Mm-hmm. And so this is not something that happens quickly.
Right.
It happens over about a 5-year span. And you described moving into that 2016, 2017, you had a growing sense of like hopelessness.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you mentioned like a panic attack or panic attacks at school.
Mm-hmm. So after my grandmother died, we had talked a little bit about, you know, depression, anxiety, not something unfamiliar to my family. And so we tried to do like a therapy session, and I was like, this is the worst. You know, like I was like, my mom's making me go to this, and you know, I don't want to have anything to do with this, and I don't want to talk about what I'm feeling. And I also then, you know, when everybody else is kind of going through it, I also don't want to put a burden on my family, who's going through things themselves. And so I was very much like, okay, well, you know, I'm going to put my head down and I'm going to keep going. And so it kind of got... It was about 3 or 4 years in, kind of 2016, where I was like, cool, cool, cool. This, like, isn't getting any better. Like, this is just getting worse. And I don't really feel like I have anybody to go to, and I don't really know what to do. And so I kind of described the way it felt was that depression and anxiety felt like a terminal illness. Of like, this is not anything that I can get out of on my own. And I had such a, but so I'd wake up every morning and I would be, you know, depressed. I wouldn't want to get out of bed, and I would just have a lot of trouble. And one time you described it to me as, you know, everybody's carrying these boxes. And some are big and some are small. And, you know, your boxes are like school and homework and, you know, my job and things like that. But then the depression anxiety boxes just got so big that they were so hard to carry. And then, you know, you'd put like one little box on top that I would think everything was fine, but then you put one little last box and it's too heavy. And it's something like, you know, my mom asking me to unload the dishwasher. And I don't realize that I'm at the point where that is the last box, but like suddenly that is becomes the hardest task in the world. You know, and they're like, it is unloading the dishwasher. Like, you know, you're in high school, you can unload the dishwasher. And I didn't have a sense of kind of just how much. Neither of us had a sense of kind of how much I was struggling.
You had mentioned being at, is Fairhaven as a camp?
Yes.
And
so,
feeling like maybe this is my last time here.
Right. So I had kind of incredible of like God being like, I'm going to save you and I'm going to get you out of this. And for me, like at the point when I felt like it was a, you know, I was so downtrodden that I was like, this is a terminal illness. God says he's going to get me out of it. And the only way to end this is death. And I kind of felt such a like a relief of like, God's going to save me and it's going to be okay. And would kind of have things of like, we would go to a cabin every fall. And I was like, maybe this is my last year here. And there's kind of a hope in that of like, a hope of like, I don't have to keep living like this. When in fact that wasn't what God meant, but.
Yeah, and you said that you would, you mentioned like that there were nights when you would pray because it felt like God was absent, and God would point out like, well, but I was here, mm-hmm. and I was here, mm-hmm. and I was here. But then you woke up the next morning and it.
Right. You know, I'd pray and be like, you know, God, where are you? Like, you say that you're going to help me in this, and I'm not really seeing it. And he'd be like, you know, today at school, you had a panic attack and you went to the bathroom, and I was right there with you. And then you went back to class, like everything was fine, and I was right there with you. And I was like, great. Do you want to, like, help out? Like, you know, like, I was like, I really appreciate that you are here with me, but I'm not seeing a lot of the benefit. And I'd wake up the next morning, and I would still be depressed and still be anxious.
And so in the spring of 2017, the school calls you guys and says, hey, we're concerned about Kate. And you said, like, that... It wasn't, you knew, but maybe not the extent, or maybe you did, but just didn't, you hadn't been through this before, so you really didn't know what to do.
Yeah. Yeah, we had what I now would describe step down, like sometimes with mental health, you kind of have stair steps, and we had stepped down several, and we knew it was a significant problem. It validated that it was a significant problem. There's a little bit of join the club, but we didn't know how many more steps we were about to take, or we were on the way. And so, because we had never done it before, or never had a child that had, you know, struggled with mental illness, because we didn't know what to do. Other than to say, thanks for the phone call, and let's keep staying present and doing the best we could to figure it out.
Yeah. And you went to see a couple local Christian, I think a psychiatrist and psychologist and a psychiatrist. And you did have an anecdote where you saw one of those guys who could diagnose, he could prescribe medication to help with anxiety and depression, mm-hmm. but his answer at the end of the session was,
I was going to this doctor, I was like, please, like, please help, like, I need something. And he was like, let's pray. And I was like, okay, like, check. You know, we've done that. Like, you know, I'm looking for some more. And he was like, we're going to pray about it.
Which is a good answer.
Right.
But felt like, do you think we haven't prayed a lot about this before? Like, we came to you not as the prayer guy, but as the doctor guy.
Yeah.
And it felt like just some ways we can church stuff up. This is how it came across when you were telling me about it. And there's an element of that as we were talking about it. Like, there's the anecdote of you put a frog in a pot and the water's cool and then you turn the heat on. The frog will just stay in the pot until the water is boiling. And the water was boiling, you know? And you can't just turn the heat off. One, that's hard to do. And two, the water's still really hot. And so at this point, when you do that, it's not going to change that quick. Like, it's too late in a way. And so when we were talking about this a few weeks ago, I asked you if you remembered the date that you attempted to take your life. Mm-hmm. And I was just like, I bet people remember the date. And you did. Mm-hmm. It was March 2nd, 2017. Mm-hmm. And then I asked, well, what were the, you know, the days and weeks and months leading up to that date like? And you pretty quickly took us back to March 2nd of 2016. Mm-hmm. And so what happened on March 2nd of 2016?
March 2nd of 2016, I was 16, and it was the first time that I had kind of cried out to God and been like, I can't do this anymore. And like, you know, God, if you are gracious, like, please let me not wake up in the morning. And I fell asleep, and that night I had a dream of that. I had an older sister that, you know, passed away before I was born, and I had a dream that I was in heaven, and she comes running up to me and gives me this big hug, and she says, I am so happy to have finally met you, but I wish it wasn't like this. And I kind of realized, I was like, okay, like, I need to wait on God's timing, and this is not something that I can, you know, take into my own hands. And I need to keep trusting God. And that kind of sustained me until, you know, a year later when I was like, you know what? Like, it has only gotten worse, and I don't see a way that I can keep going.
And that, a dream, A, you do have an older sister that was stillborn. Like, this is not a dream about some random person. This is your sister.
Right.
And you said that dream was like more than just a normal dream, mm-hmm. like the most real dream you've ever had. Mm-hmm. And sustained you, you know, for a year. You had mentioned in this part of the conversation, there was an element of self-harm mm-hmm. that had started years earlier.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. There's kind of the first kind of thought you have when you, you know, aren't doing well is kind of like, oh, I wish, like, something could happen and I could just have a break, like, from life. Like, I wish I could be sick or could be injured and could be in the hospital and could have a break. And I wish that, you know, then I would see who would come see me in the hospital, you know, who would really care. Was kind of my first inclination of, like, I'm not doing, several years before, it's like, I'm not doing as well as, you know, maybe I thought I was. And yes, and then, you know, they're kind of turned into, you know, self-harm, and for several years, which again is not something that goes away magically.
Yeah, and I think, I would imagine most folks have the thought at times, like, nobody cares. I wonder who cares. Mm-hmm. But you're just in a place where you're taking that further and you're trying to figure out, how can I find out who
right.
really cares?
Right.
You mentioned the passage that we read today from Psalm 139, where shall I go from your spirit? Where shall I flee from your presence? If I ascend to heaven, you're there. If I make my bed in Sheol, you're there. If I take the wings of the morning and dwell in the uttermost parts of the sea, even there your hand shall lead me and your right hand shall hold me. If I say, surely the darkness shall cover me and the light about me be night, even the darkness is not dark to you and the night is bright as the day, for darkness is as light with you. That was a verse that stuck with you through this mm-hmm. time. Mm-hmm. What was it about that passage?
Just kind of this hope of, like, everything's going to be okay if God is here. You know, and like, the darkness is going to be light. And one, that he is bigger and stronger than all of that. And two, that he was with me in the darkness, and it was still dark. And just kind of this frustration with that. But that, yeah, it's a really hopeful verse for me.
But a year later, March 2nd, 2017, things haven't gotten better. It's been a year. That seems mm-hmm. to be the thing of, like, what can happen? And I asked you, like, what you know, what are you thinking and feeling that night? And he said, not much.
Yeah. I'd kind of gotten to a point of like, there wasn't a whole lot left. There wasn't a lot of things to feel or things to think, and very much kind of felt
like you're done.
Yeah.
And so you make an attempt, and that night you have another dream, vision.
I think it was more of a vision, but I was could see myself falling and knew that when I hit the ground, like, I would have died. And God reached out his hand and just caught me right before I hit the ground. And then I woke up the next morning, and I was still depressed, and I was still anxious, and I was really mad. I was really mad at God. I was like, you're catching me, and you're throwing me right back in to the same thing. And I know that this is not the way that you want me to go, but I don't know what is. And so that night, then, you know, the next night, I got
out. You just went to school.
I went to school. And
your dad was out of town.
Dad was out of town.
Didn't tell your mom.
Didn't tell anybody.
Just went to school.
Just went to school. And then, you know, that night, I was still feeling pretty hopeless. And you came back into town, and I asked you to take me to the hospital. Just that, like, I was like, I need somebody to help. And so then we went to the emergency room, and they sent me to, like, an inpatient facility. Holly Hill is part of Wake Med, I think. And they were like, we're gonna send you over there. You know, you all need some time and some extra help. And it was pretty helpful as someone who had never seen a therapist before. You know, it was like, it was very helpful, and I learned, you know, coping skills and things like that, and there wasn't, you know, shame around what people were thinking and feeling, because everybody was kind of in the same boat. And they had like kind of like a visiting hour in the evenings where people could come and visit. And, you know, just really something. You know, mom and dad showed up and just cried, you know, for like a long time. And I was kind of like, okay, cool. You know, and like, that's how you were doing. And then, you know, my brother showed up, and his wife, and I think he just kind of stared at me like for a little bit. Like, he's not a real emotional guy, and just, neither of them had any idea what to do. We just kind of sat there. But my young life leader showed up and brought cards, and we played cards, and we didn't have to talk about what was going on. We just played. And that was a really big of, like, of God showing up in the middle of that.
Something we've said a bit over the years, a friend said to me years ago, is he was saying it physically with folks that he was working with, but emotionally or spiritually or whatever, like, I can't pay your light bill, but I can sit here with you in the dark. And that's what that felt like to me, is Katie Kilgore knew, and she'd been there before. Mm-hmm. Like, she had a little experience, and she ended up going to school and becoming a counselor, right? Like, she was, this is what God had gifted her to do. And she knew just to come and sit there with you in the dark. Mm-hmm. Like, yeah, things are completely out of control. Let's play cards.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, and she knew, you know, her role. You know, I need a friend, and I need somebody to hang out with. And I'd spent all day talking about what was wrong, and I, you know, needed a break.
And so you left there, but they had taught you some, you were then seeing a therapist. They had taught, what coping skills did they work through with you?
I mean, like, the most basic, like, do a little Google search, you know, like, some breathing techniques. I mean, several things. But.
They helped?
Yeah, they helped. It helped.
But didn't, like, magically, right. Like, you can turn the heat off, but the pot's right. Still hot, and it takes a while to cool down.
Yeah.
And so in the next few weeks or months, you're better. It's getting better, but it's not there. And yeah. 6 weeks later.
6 weeks later, I realized I was like, I'm still struggling. Less with depression, more with anxiety. You know, would have panic attacks every day at school. That would be, you know, multiple hours. And then I had one. And they ended up calling, 911. And they took me to the emergency room. And I said, I think I need to go back to Holly Hill. I think I need more. And making that decision for myself was really big. Was really big for me. And I went back, it's kind of helpful. but kind of taking it into my own hands was really big, and realizing that I had the power to do something, and I had the power to seek help and to ask for help. And I saw a therapist who, you know, like, wasn't Christian, and that was a really big help for me after some of my doctor experiences in the past. And when I was able to realize, like, okay, like, and be involved, I felt like I was kind of back at the wheel of my life a little bit, and kind of being like, okay, like, it's not just what's happening to me. That was really big.
Let me add, that was really the beginning of a game changer, because she was saying, I'm choosing to help, get help. Katie showed up again in the waiting room, looked at her in the eye and said, you can do this. And it was the most beautiful display of Christianity I think I've ever seen with this young life leader. But I will say that also her choosing a non-Christian therapist, it was more her choosing to get help with somebody she was going to and needed to help. I mean, those kind of decisions in her to ask for help, pursue help to grow, basically, is really what ended up changing the whole thing, because it was well beyond our control and knowledge of what to do.
And I think, like, I want to clarify a little bit of, like, it's not like you're depressed and anxious and one day you decide that you're going to get help and it all gets better. It was the fact of being in high school and my parents had chosen all the routes for me. And when I said, I need to choose someone that I trust. And when they let me kind of take charge of that, that was a really big.
And let me clarify, it wasn't the Christian counselor versus the non-Christian counselor that was the point. It was that you were choosing and going, pursuing help.
Yeah, I remember, like, you weren't here. You were in town. And we talked a lot because we were friends, but you were on staff. We didn't talk all the time. But I do remember the call when you said the second time and she chose to go. She self-admitted, and that being just a huge deal that you did that. And you had mentioned something about the not being a Christian counselor, that you didn't feel as much shame with a non-Christian counselor, which is kind of like a church culture thing, like, in general. And part of the reason we do the series is to kind of poke out some of that stuff. And we have it, you know what I mean? We all have it. But that there's some element where you felt less shame you know, sharing that with somebody outside of the, it's not that you were looking for help apart from Christ necessarily, yeah, you know, but yeah. like that it was just all the dynamics in it that are complicated and sometimes really hard to like discern. Yeah. And then you got, you did get better quicker. So you, that mm-hmm. summer, you were like in the woods with a group of people you don't know for some program. Tell us a little mm-hmm. bit about that.
Yeah, so that was all kind of March and May. And then in July, I did like a leadership program where we did like backpacking and theology and some mission work with the Salvation Army. And that was helped that leader, you know, I'd kind of emailed because I had applied earlier and then because y'all wanted me to and I was trying to win brownie points. I didn't actually want to go. And so I had emailed them. I was like, hey, I'm in a really tough spot, you know, and I don't know, like, I'm doing a lot better. And the leader was like, I've been in a similar spot, and I'm going to walk with you through this. And I was like, I don't know who you are, but okay. And that was really big. And, yeah, and they were, I mean, it was great of like, I'd wake up in the middle of the night, you know, and they'd be right there and things like that. And so, you know, for not everybody, and I remember you also went on a trip with your brother at the same time. And I think that was helpful for you. You know, it doesn't always help of like, let's go on a trip and have fun. You know, like your problems will still exist, you know, at the beach. But for us, that helped a lot.
You also made the comment about you got injured while you were in the woods someplace.
Yeah. After all this, then I ended up, like, I fell while hiking and, like, bruised my femur. And, like, as soon as I got back from the hiking trip, I got out of the van and they, like, handed me crutches. And it's kind of ironic of, like, all this time. And I was like, great, now I'm injured, you know, like.
But you said you felt more injured on the outside than you did on the inside.
So I think, yeah, a lot of the trap of mental illness is you're like, I wish I looked sick. You know, like, someone could look at me and be like, I have no idea, you know, what was going on. And you're like, I wish the outside could reflect the inside. And now, you know, then I was injured and I was like, but I'm doing okay. You know, this is kind of the worst pain I'm in right now is on the outside.
Yeah, that's a big deal.
Yeah.
And you said, like, this is not something that goes away completely. Mm-hmm. You still deal with it, but it moved mm-hmm. from you made one comment about going back to 2016, probably, that your first class at school was dance. Mm-hmm. And that kind of got you out of bed in the morning.
Yeah, I said several times, I was like, if my first class in the morning was math, I was like, I would not be going to school, you know, but my first class in the morning was a dance class, and that's what got me to school. Then I'd do the rest of the day. But kind of that, like, there was something every day that I got out of bed for.
Yeah, and I think, and as we talked again yesterday, I was thinking about how when people come to church, just people that we don't know that because we're a church, ask for financial help. And we've got a part of the budget where we can do that. So I will help people out financially without asking them any questions because I learned early, like, if I ask them questions, I'm begging them to lie to me. Like if I didn't know where I was going to stay or had trouble feeding my kids, I would tell you anything I thought you wanted to hear, you know. And so I just don't do that. I'm like, hey, we got some money in the budget right now. Let me help you. Graham and I spent like 5 hours driving a guy to a couple different Walmarts to pay for his glasses a couple months ago because we had the time and the church had money in that budget and the guy was great. But I realized when those people hit the door and they don't know where they're going to sleep, they're thinking, like, we think season by season, like, you guys are maxing out your 401ks and putting money in your 529s for your kids' college. Like, you think way out there. Or you think, where are we going to go on vacation next summer? What's the next house we're going to buy? Or what's my next career move? But the people that come to the door of the church asking for a few dollars are thinking hour by hour or day by day. And they cannot think. And really what I want is to help them out a few times and then say, hey, Let me get a group of people around you that can help you think week by week or month by month. Or you suspend your judgment and let us help you and make some decisions for you. And I realized you were thinking hour by hour. Oh, I got dance class, you know. But slowly that changed. And you're thinking week by week and month by month and year by year and season by season. And that's kind of where you are now with all of it.
Yeah. Yeah, you slowly just start to have more good moments than bad moments, and then good days than bad days, and then good weeks than bad weeks, and then it just slowly gets better. And I think it did for all of us. You know, like, we were in a rough spot relationally, and it got better.
So I'll ask the question, where was God and when your life happened, when all this happened? And I think we've answered that in a couple of different ways. There's a like a vision or a dream that Lindsay had that we haven't put in there, but like God was like, hey, I'm in control. Like, I know what's going on. And so there are various ways, but I don't, just if you think about that question, where was God in the midst of this?
I said once of like, you know, my dear sweet mother was like kind of right outside my bedroom door, kind of all the time, like, you know, kind of doing stuff, but like really trying to be right there. And what I wish she had known is that God was in the room with me of that, you know. And this is a little bit of like what I wish my parents have known, is that I needed them to be my parents and not my therapist or my psychiatrist or my, you know, my young life leader or my phone police or, you know, any of those things. And I needed them to know that they couldn't do more than God, and they shouldn't try.
And you had a great answer for that question.
Yeah, I learned I wasn't God. So a couple things. One is, you know, I had a real significant failure emotionally in the years this was going on. And I noticed when our older two were in middle school that they were talking to Lindsay, but not talking to me. And they loved me. I loved them. That wasn't the problem. It's just that I wasn't listening. And thankfully, Lindsay really listened well. And the thing I watched her and learned from her on their back half, both of them, middle school and high school years, is the importance of listening to your kids. And Lindsay really was outside the door. I was very much over my head. Lindsay was a really great, just really great mom. Always has been. But one thing she did right when she was gone to the wilderness and theology and missions experience is we got a break. And then she came to me and said, let's make her senior year the best year ever. And so we started to play together. And that was the most helpful thing on our end, is to not, because everything was so intense, which is what Katie was doing when she was playing cards, is just, yes, dealing with it, but lightening things up and those kind of things. So we went to Coldplay concert. She was like baffled by how much money could be poured into a concert and how great it could be. We watched whatever she wanted to watch on Netflix, and we just really started pursuing her as just parents that were out of control, but just friends and parents. And so I think that was, that letting go of control was something that we knew we needed to do in high school. How much and how quick we were out of control was really, really fast, and too fast for us, but exactly what needed to happen. I don't think we were controlling, but just the natural movement from parenting out of authority to parenting out of influence. It all moved so fast that we were completely out of control, which was the exact thing she needed from the Lord. So even though I was absent as a father, figuratively speaking, I mean, her father was with her in the bathrooms, in the rooms, and wherever she went. And that's why that Psalm 139 means so much, is that we're not going to always be with her, but God always will.
Yeah, and it's significant, I feel like, because every parent feels like, because they have failed. But God is there, like, it's okay. God is there. And you kind of answered the second question, which is what advice would you give parents in a similar situation? And I think what you just said is listen a lot. Don't try and control the thing. I mean, I think earlier you said giving Kate agency was a big element, like that's what she needed. And that is kind of the transition from you control everything that goes on to like letting your kids.
And play. Because play, for all of us, but especially kids, it's the way you do relationships. And if you aren't playing or enjoying or showing delight in doing experiences or adventures together, first of all, you're missing life together. But second of all, you're missing relationship. And so I can't understate how important that is to those two things. So.
And what's your advice to either teens that or adults that are struggling, like they resonate with your story maybe more than they realized or more than they want to admit, or to parents, like what would you say?
Yeah, I think I would ask for help a lot sooner than I did. I think that, you know, depression, anxiety is that this is not the path you have to go down. And I'd say, like, if you are in middle school or high school and you feel a little bit of, you know, yourself in this story, I would say, you know, go to your parents and be like, I think, you know, I want to see a therapist or something. And that can be all it is. You know, it doesn't have to be, you know, a big thing because, you know, a therapist outside or a psychologist or a counselor or somebody outside of your family is going to do, you know, a lot more help than anybody inside your family. And that, you know, please come talk to me, you know, like, it can be super overwhelming, but, you know, you're not the first one. You're not the only one. And that, you know, one day you're going to turn around and be like, oh, man, my parents, like, are kind of cool. And, like, they were really just doing their best. You know, it wasn't great, but Lord knows they were trying. So.
Well, thank you so much for having the courage to share your story with us. We appreciate it. I think it's so, like, timely, given so much of what's going on right now and just where culture is and so many people that are struggling with this. And the honesty of it is just, you know, I think it's great for us as a church. So I'm going to finish by reading the end of the way that Psalm 139 moves on from there. It's not the end. I only went through verse 18, but it says, "For you formed my inward parts. You knitted me together in my mother's womb. I praise you, for I'm fearfully and wonderfully made. Wonderful are your works, and my soul knows it very well. My frame was not hidden from you when I was being made in secret, intricately woven in the depths of the earth. Your eyes saw my unformed substance. In your book were written every one of them, the days that were formed for me, when as yet there was none of them. How precious to me are your thoughts, O God. How vast is the sum of them. If I would count them, they are more than the sand. I awake, and I am still with you." Father, we're grateful for Kate. We're grateful for this story. We're grateful for the honesty of it. We're grateful for the places that we can see you in it. There's so many times, Lord, when What we want from you is just to fix the problem the way we want you to fix the problem, and it's rare that you will do that. Probably, maybe because it's rare that we know what we're talking about, but we're grateful that in this story we can see your presence and your sovereignty and the people that you put along the way, and we're grateful for healing that you brought to Kate, Father, and for the plans that you have for her in her life, Lord. And I pray for those that are here or that are listening or those that aren't, Lord, that are dealing with similar struggles, God, I pray that you would intervene in a way that they would get the help that will be truly helpful, Lord, and that they would know that you are in the midst of it. Even when it's really hard for us to see that you're in the midst of it. Jesus, we love you, and we're grateful, and we pray this in your name. Amen.